Budget deal that would avert the automatic tax hikes and spending cuts set to take place on January 1st. And while Republicans and Democrats have been very public about their disagreements, it looks like President Obama and House Speaker Boehner are going to be meeting alone to try to hammer out a deal. The president has said he's not going to budge on his demand for increasing taxes for the wealthy while retaining the Bush tax cuts for everyone else. Republicans are calling for further spending cuts and changes in the tax code rather than tax increases on the upper 2%. We asked Michael Grunwald, senior national correspondent for Time magazine, to join us. His story in the current edition of the magazine is titled How to Avoid the Fiscal Cliff. He is the author of The New Deal, The Hidden Story of Change in the Obama Era, and was a guest on Radio Time to talk about that book. And Mike, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me, Marty.
You call this a slope, not a cliff. How come?
Well, it's not like on January 1st, there's, an immediate, $500 billion austerity hit. Taxes will go up. There are spending cuts that will be phased in. But we're talking about, there's essentially these spending cuts go in over 10 years. It's not like the government, huge chunks of the government immediately disappear. It's not like the deficit suddenly explodes. It's quite the opposite. We start to go on this gradual slope towards a lower deficit. The other good news is that, it's not going to happen like that, particularly on the tax side. You can already see the Republicans sort of negotiating the terms of their surrender. Everybody seems to want these middle-class tax cuts to be extended. The question is how to let the upper-income tax cuts expire without Republican fingerprints, which shouldn't be that difficult.
Is this a manufactured crisis? And if it is, who's to blame, do you think?
Absolutely is manufactured. In fact, the whole point of the fiscal cliff was that these tax increases and spending cuts were supposed to be so unpalatable that nobody would want them, and therefore the two sides would be forced to come to a deal for this grand bargain on long-term deficit reduction, which, of course, didn't happen, or at least hasn't happened, with 3 weeks to go. But absolutely, this came out about in 2011 when the debt limit, the U.S. was about to reach its debt limit, and it wasn't like we didn't have money to pay our debt. We just needed this formal extension of the debt limit, essentially Congress authorizing the president to continue meeting the U.S. government's obligations. And the Republicans essentially said, no, we're not going to do it unless essentially President Obama rolls back the welfare state and adopts Republican policies. He refused. There was this standoff. The U.S. debt actually got downgraded, which was a kind of crazy thing. Finally, with this kind of standoff where everybody's pointing guns at each other, they agreed, well, we can't come to an agreement now, but we'll set up the situation so that before 2013 happens, these cuts will be so unpleasant that we'll have to come to a deal.
But of course,
they haven't.
And that's how we do legislation these days in Washington?
Yeah, it's a really kind of crazy way to run a railroad.
Or a country.
Yeah, that's for sure.
Let me quote something that you wrote in Swampland, and this actually goes back to the Bush years, and you write, but it's simply a fact that Republicans controlled Washington during the fiscally irresponsible era when President Clinton's budget surpluses were transformed into the trillion-dollar deficit that President Bush bequeathed to President Obama, and then you write in parentheses, the deficit is now shrinking. Is that where the blame should squarely be placed?
Yeah, I mean, you probably saw, I've been kind of banging my spoon on my high chair about the media's sort of enabling of not just Republican hypocrisy, but Republican BS. reasonable people can disagree about some of these policy issues, but the facts are the facts, and it's just been kind of dizzying for after a year where we've seen Republicans insisting that they had no intention of cutting Medicare and attacking Obama for cutting Medicare and insisting that anybody who claimed they want to cut Medicare is a demagogue. The day after the election, they're already complaining that Obama doesn't want to cut Medicare enough and he's irresponsible. Similarly, after a year of complaining that Obama has no plan, to deal with, you know, our fiscal situation. Obama puts out a plan, and immediately they're complaining that it's a recycled plan, which is sort of weird since they had been saying for a year that he didn't have a plan. So what was he recycling? What kind of irritates me is the way my colleagues in the mainstream media, we don't know how to deal with this. Mm. We just sort of, you know, dutifully pass along their claims that they don't want to cut Medicare, and then the next day we pass along their claims that Obama is insufficiently ambitious in cutting Medicare, as if nothing had ever changed. It's like yesterday never happened, and every day is a new day in Washington.
Would it be fair to say, though, that at least in the last maybe year or two after the stimulus bill, that the deficit has actually been shrinking?
Yeah, no, it has. You know, President Obama, look, the causes of the deficit are pretty clear. Obviously, we had these huge surpluses in 2001. We had these big tax cuts were a big part of the deficit. We had these wars and security spending and the Bush prescription drug benefit that also increased the deficit. And then we had this huge financial collapse and economic, the Great Recession, which has been the other major driver. And that's why when Obama took office, the Congressional Budget Office predicted a $1.2 trillion deficit. And then he had the stimulus bill, which increased it some, but that has now, you know, we're not still spending stimulus money. And the deficit is now, as the economy has improved somewhat, the deficit has just slipped below $1 trillion. It's still a big deficit. We're spending a lot more than we're taking in. But again, you know, we've seen what happens in Great Britain and in Spain, where they've tried austerity as the answer, and what you happen is you launch right back into a double-dip recession. And when people don't have jobs and corporations don't have profits, they don't pay as much in taxes, and deficits get even bigger. So, yeah, we're in this sort of problem that's been created through years of irresponsibility, ironically, the answer is not immediate belt tightening, even though a lot of families and businesses have had to do that. We have a jobs crisis, not a deficit crisis. We're not Greece.
And some people seem to think that we are Greece. But again, to quote you, and this is your most recent piece in Time magazine, the economy needs more stimulus. And I know that the president has talked about a $200 billion worth of stimulus programs in his particular budget. Do you think that's enough money to actually stimulate the economy and get some more people back to work?
Well, look, the economy is starting to, you know, it's showing signs that it's doing a little better. And this is not like, it's not 2009 where you need a really massive stimulus. People, you know, the word stimulus has become so toxic. You know, I wrote an entire book about it, where people say, oh, we don't want stimulus. But then when you find out what he's actually talking about, extending unemployment benefits, extending payroll tax cuts for the middle class, maybe some relief for victims of Hurricane Sandy, maybe some infrastructure spending on our roads and bridges and subways that are falling apart, then it suddenly sounds a little bit less controversial. And, yeah, I do think that, putting some more money in people's pockets and creating some jobs, you know, for the guys who lay the asphalt and fix the city buses, those are going to be helpful, particularly at the margins. And what, you know, pretty much every analysis of the 2009 stimulus showed that it did create jobs, it really was the difference between recession and growth, and that what our problems, to the extent we have big problems in the economy, they're demand problems. People need more money. There isn't some kind of structural problem. If there was a huge structural problem in the U.S. economy, you'd see, like, you know, that this mismatch for people with the wrong jobs. You'd see the really high wages for areas where they needed people with those skills. But that's not what's happening. Wages have been depressed and unemployment has been high, and we need more jobs. What we don't need is this kind of instant austerity, which people have been talking about for years. But at this point, as you see, these Republicans who for 4 years have been claiming that Keynesianism is communism and the government can't create jobs, but now seem to agree that going over the fiscal cliff would actually hurt the economy. You hear them saying that these defense cuts would actually kill jobs. They're essentially acknowledging that, yeah, you know, we don't want to completely roll back the government's role in the economy right now because the economy is soft and it needs support.
But do you think that entitlements and maybe even means testing certain entitlements, do you think that should be on the table for discussion?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think, you know, it's not made up, this idea that we have a long-term deficit problem. Mm-hmm. If you look at the numbers, it's actually almost entirely a healthcare cost problem. If you look at the long-term projections, for Medicare and Medicaid, it looks like a ski slope. Those numbers are just go up and up and up. For the rest of the government, it's essentially like a sidewalk. That's not the problem. So if there are ideas to try to rein in healthcare costs, which Obamacare really started to make an effort towards reining in some of the, you know, reining in some of the waste in the system without trying to slash benefits from people who need it, you know, it absolutely should be on the table because you can't get serious about the long-term deficit and then at the same time say Medicaid and Medicare have nothing to do with it. Now, Social Security, that to me seems entirely different. It seems ain't broke, don't need to be fixed. But if Republicans and Democrats can agree on some long-term entitlement changes, that hopefully wouldn't hurt people in real need, that could be helpful. The good news about the fiscal cliff, though, is that while these tax cuts, you know, they expire and sort of something needs to be done because there's a huge disagreement where Obama is perfectly willing to let the upper income tax cuts expire, so essentially they will. These spending cuts that kick in on January 1st, nobody really wants them. There's much more leeway to kind of kick the can down the road. It's not like they need to come up with $4 trillion in deficit reduction or $2 trillion in deficit reduction. Congress created this cliff, and Congress can get rid of it however they want. So whatever they can agree on, they can agree on, and everything else they can agree not to agree.
And we're almost up on a break here, but do you think there is some agreement, though, to extend the Bush tax cuts for those making less than the top 2%, the 98% of the country? That's something that the president has been pushing on, but do you think that has some kind of, and apparently it's quite a popular idea, do you think the Republicans can sign on to that?
I do. I think that will happen, whether it happens sort of with their fingerprints or without it. One important thing to remember about those tax cuts, which people often say that Obama wants to just get rid of the tax cuts for people making more than $250,000 a year, it's good to remember that actually it's just for income above $250,000 a year. So everybody gets to keep their tax cuts on their income up to $250,000, including people who are billionaires. It's just that on their income above that level, their marginal income, there they will be taxed at a higher rate than the rate of the Clinton years, which weren't so bad.
Let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation with Michael Grunwald. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Big Blue Marble Bookstore, an independent, locally owned bookstore in the heart of Mount Airy Village, carrying smart, fun books for all ages. For details on author events, book clubs, story times, and more, BigBlueMarbleBooks.com.
The Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts supports WHYY. PAFA's Office of Admissions is hosting an open house on Saturday, December 15th from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. with information about the 3 undergraduate and 2 graduate programs of study at the nation's first museum and fine arts school. PAFA's curriculum focuses on the following areas of fine arts study: painting, drawing, printmaking, and sculpture. Info at 215-972-7625 or admissions at pafa.edu.
Yuck, they're greasy.
I know, Michael said. They're not as good as my mom's.
A fourth grader fries his own latkes and cooks up a small miracle. And an uncertain young life is mysteriously redirected. I'm Susan Stamberg. Join me and Murray Horowitz for the 2012 edition of Hanukkah Lights from NPR.
Monday night at 10 on WHYY.
Wherever you live, whatever you're into, Newsworks.org has you covered. Philadelphia city life, New Jersey politics, small wonders in Delaware, the arts, health and science. Newsworks.org is on it. Smart, local, news. Covered.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, talking with Michael Grunewald. He's a senior national correspondent for Time magazine. In fact, has a story in the current edition of the magazine titled How to Avoid the Fiscal Cliff, author of a book that came out earlier this year called The New New Deal, The Hidden Story of Change in the Obama Era. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get Mike from Woodstown to join us. And Mike, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Good morning, Mike. Thank you again. Congratulations on another great show.
Thank you so
much. I do have to take exception with your guest on just about every point that he stated. His political bias is clearly obvious. I don't think he needs to reiterate that. We obviously know he's an anti-Republican, pro-Democrat, pro-Obama.
Well, hold on.
And that's
Mike, I'll let you finish your point, but I'm going to give Michael Grunewald a chance to respond to your description of him. But go ahead, Mike, from Woodstown, just finish your thought.
I will, thank you. I find it kind of amusing that he states that the deficit is clearly going down. Is he referring to the fact that it's going down from the extremely high level that Obama drove it to, the highest in history, 4 years in a row, over $1 trillion? Is he referring to it going down from that number?
Well, Mike, let's find out. And Mike Grunewald, go ahead.
Well, your caller seems to be hearing impaired. As I mentioned, he inherited a $1.2 trillion deficit his first year. It's come down to about $1 trillion. Obama did not blow up the deficit. You can look at actually, there are graphics that I think ran with my article that show what made up the deficit. The vast majority of it is the Great Recession plus the Bush tax cuts plus the security spending that he inherited and the prescription drug benefit that also passed under Bush. He did contribute to the deficit by extending the Bush tax cuts. The stimulus did increase the deficit somewhat at the beginning, but no longer does. But overall, you know, there are millions of graphs that will show you that that overall the deficit is shrinking, that it is less than the nightmare he inherited when we were losing 800,000 jobs a month and the GDP was crashing at an 8.9% annual rate. That's depression territory. People forget that, you know, when the economy goes to hell, it's not just bad for jobs, it's bad for the deficit. Because people without jobs and corporations without profits don't pay the same amount in taxes. And what the deficit is a comparison to how much we're spending versus how much we're taking in. And when we stop taking in, that's when the deficit explodes. As for my bias,
and with your,
it's
and
true,
a,
I've, been
apologist.
Kind of, I've been on a bit of an anti-Republican jihad. It's not really pro-anybody. I just, but again, it's just sort of fact-based. You can't be sort of pro-Medicare and against Medicare at the same time. You know, you can't be, why does Obama have no plan and why is this plan an old plan at the same time? That's more my, you know, the kind of defiance of reality on issues like climate and Keynesian economics that used to be just, you know, settled logic for everybody where you can disagree about the ideology but agree about the facts. That sort of disappeared in a few years. I'm pretty middle of the road in my politics.
Now, Mike, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well, and that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Mike Grunewald, this gets us a little bit into the weeds, but there is, and this is the way we, I guess, do budgeting in this country, these things called tax expenditures, which we think of as deductions. Things like deducting the home mortgage or health care coverage that you get through your job or charitable deductions. And the Republicans seem to believe that if you look at some of these deductions or look at our tax code, we can figure out ways of getting more revenue out of, I guess, people out of the country without having to increase those tax rates. Do those numbers add up, do you think?
Well, they don't add up in terms of as a replacement for increasing tax rates, because, you know, it's one of those, you know, like Willie Sutton said about, you know,
where the money is, right?
You got to go where the money is. But that said, you know, we're really kind of set up to actually do some positive bipartisan tax reform. What's going to have to happen first is essentially the rates will go up on January 1st, and Republicans will be able to just sort of raise their hands and blame it on Obama. And it will be on Obama. It'll be, you know, he's the one who wants to do it. The middle class rates will be extended. But then you'll have sort of more revenue to play with for a possibility where you could see some of the kinds of taxes that really do hurt people, payroll taxes, which are a real drag on families, corporate taxes, which are a real drag on corporations. You could imagine a situation where those are lowered, and the kind of deductions you mentioned, not only on the home mortgage for, you know, McMansions and, you know, charitable deductions, which has in some places become a real racket, but also the health care, the employer-based health care exclusion. The 401k savings has become a really big-ticket item. Things like carried interest for, you know, guys who run hedge funds, and the reason that Mitt Romney had a lower tax rate than his secretary. Those kind of things can be, you know, you can imagine a situation where there could be some agreement that if we get rid of some of those loopholes, which end up being really regressive,
mm-hmm.
like the home mortgage, you get a bigger, from that deduction, you get a bigger advantage if you have a bigger house, a more expensive house, and you get a bigger advantage if you have a higher tax rate. So you can imagine rolling that back, which would be politically difficult, but if it's offset by reducing rates or, you know, particularly payroll and corporate taxes, you could imagine there being some common ground. I just don't think that's going to happen before January 1st.
There's so many powerful constituencies, though, for those deductions or loopholes or tax expenditures.
That's right. That's right. And the problem is that, you know, the realtors and the housing industry cares a lot more about the mortgage deduction
right.
than you and me, in the same way that, you know, there ought to be great bipartisan agreement on, say, farm subsidies, which are a preposterous, you know, that's just a way of redistributing money from the non-agricultural sector to the agricultural sector, mostly to really very well-off farmers. And when I went to Washington for a story recently, I talked to the liberal think tanks and the conservative think tanks and asked them, where should we cut spending? And everybody, the first thing they said is agriculture.
Interesting.
But if you tried to do it, you know, the farm industry, the farm lobby really cares about that stuff, and everybody else not so much. So they tend to dominate farm policy. Farm, you know, congressmen and from farm states tend to be on the farm committees, and we, you know, nobody ever said this stuff is going to be easy.
Well, and I should add that you, Walt, you can't balance the budget by defunding PBS, NPR, or NEA. That's something that you also write about in your article.
Right. Even though your earlier caller might be surprised to hear that I'm one of those guys who, I lop off Big Bird's head. I don't think the government should be funding NPR, no offense, or PBS, or the NEA. I think the government should really be focusing on the things where it's really vital that only government can do it. That said, you're fooling yourself if you think you're going to balance your budget by getting rid of these very small ticket items. You got to go hunting where the ducks are, and that's health care.
And that's Michael Grunewald, senior national correspondent for Time magazine, joining us today on Radio Times to talk about some of what he writes in a recent edition of the magazine, a story titled How to Avoid the Fiscal Cliff. And again, wrote a book earlier this year called The New Deal, The Hidden Story of Change in the Obama Era. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Let me see what Randy from Bluebell has to say. And Randy, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hello.
Hi there.
A few minutes ago, the host or the guest spoke to the effect of we're actually spending more than we're taking in revenue-wise, and yet the deficit is being reduced. How is that possible?
How is that possible, Michael?
Because we're not spending as much more than we're taking in than we were before when Obama took office. So, in other words, when he took office, we were spending $1.3 $1 trillion more than we were taking in. Now we're just spending, right, you know, $990 billion more than we were taking in. It's not ideal, but again, you would say it was a crisis if markets were freaking out about it and interest rates were going way up. But interest rates are at historic lows, which shows that the market is not at all concerned about it. The problem right now is jobs.
Thanks for calling in, Randy. And just a reminder that the Bush tax cuts were instituted because there was actually a surplus when Clinton left office and Bush was elected president.
That's right. That's right. It was, those were the days.
Those certainly were the days. It is, and maybe this says something about once a tax cut has been instituted, it is really hard, maybe impossible, to unfund that tax cut.
Well, we'll see. Yeah. I mean, one thing to remember about is, we've had this whole election, which was sort of, certainly played out, and rightfully so, as this real clash of governing philosophies, sort of anti-government team versus, the big government team. But remember, what we're really arguing about is, whether tax rates should be 36% or 39% for, a couple million Americans just on their income above $250,000. These are not, necessarily great ideological principles at stake. That's not to say that, how we budget does have a big effect on how, how the country works. But again, this notion that somehow we're returning to some kind of communism, socialism, by returning tax rates for the top income levels to the level they were when we were gaining 22 million jobs under Bill Clinton, it doesn't necessarily mean it's the right thing to do, but it's not some kind of, radical transformation of American government.
Let me see what John from Kensington has to say. John, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Is that a here? Oh.
Go ahead, John. Yeah. Go ahead, John.
Hello.
Hi, John. You're on the air, John.
Oh, yeah. Listen, I'm from one of those rare people. I'm like, raise the taxes. I mean, I only make $30,000. I got two kids, but, I live in Philadelphia. We pay high taxes. I'm like, keep the recreation centers open. I'm fine with that. But the thing of it is, if I buy a house, the only way I'm going to do it is with a home mortgage deduction.
Right.
And when I hear the Republicans talk about cutting it, I'm like, that's going to kill the housing market. I mean, I know it's kind of a giveaway, but, it's also like the way, a lot of people with hardly any money or little money get into the housing market in the first place. So
it's a fair point, John.
I cannot believe no one talks about this, but it blows my mind.
Well, okay. I'm glad you called in because I want to hear what Michael Grumland has to say.
You know, it's a great point. But I guess what I would respond, because this is one where, in an ideal world, I think we would really roll back some of the home mortgage deduction. I'd roll back all of it. But I think politically, you'd want to roll it back, particularly at the top end. We can choose how to tax people. And the question is the sort of overall tax burden. And a guy like, I think his name was John making $30,000 a year, that's not, he's working as hard as somebody who's making a lot more, and we don't want to be going after him on taxes. The question is, for the biggest bite for John is his payroll taxes, right, which are, which no matter how much, you heard Mitt Romney say that 47% of the country doesn't pay income taxes, which is sort of technically true if you talk about the income tax, but we all pay taxes on our income, including John. And so you could imagine a deal where you'd lower the amount of his payroll tax, that FICA thing that you see in your paycheck every week, and instead you reduce the home mortgage deduction, which does benefit John, but benefits Mitt Romney a lot more because he has a more expensive house, and he has a higher tax rate, so he has much bigger deductions. It's a much less efficient way to do it. I know you're going to have a guest next who's going to talk about carbon taxes.
That's right.
Which are politically, probably not going to happen. But that would be an even more efficient way to tax us, because at the same time we'd be raising revenue, we'd also be discouraging the kind of actions that are destroying the planet and increasing our dependence on foreign petro thugs and so forth. It's the the question is, what's the tax burden going to be? How much revenue are we going to raise? And then how are we going to go about raising it? Are we going to tax work, or are we going to tax wealth? Are we going to, you know, give benefits for people on the low end? Are we going to give it for people on the high end? Are we going to attach these benefits to housing or to savings or to consuming health care, or to being a hedge fund guy, or to having a corporate jet, which, believe it or not, there's a deduction for? These are the kind of larger questions that will be dealt with in a larger tax reform, probably not dealt with before January 1st as they just try to avoid the cliff.
John, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Mike, let me ask you about something. This will show what a complete nerd I am, but I saved an article from September where you were featured with a beautiful picture of your adorable family at the kitchen table. And it's headlined, One Nation on Welfare, Living Your Life on the Dole. For example, there's your lovely little girl. The IRS allows a $3,800 tax exemption per child and more per child care. There's a picture of you wearing a cotton shirt. Cotton subsidies approach $1.3 billion a year. The idea that we, and perhaps this was in response to the 47% or at least the presidential race that was going on, but the idea is that we're all moochers, I guess.
All right. Well, believe it or not, that story actually ran a week before his 47% comments came out, so it was pretty well timed. But yeah, I mean, I think it was a response to this notion that we're a nation divided between makers and takers. As I mentioned earlier, in fact, anybody who has a job is a maker, and that 47% that Mitt did talk about. Many of those are working people. Some of them are in the military. Others are people on Social Security who used to work. So we're all makers. But then the flip side is that it turns out we're all takers, too. And we don't always realize the way we take. I talked about how I live in subsidized housing because of my mortgage interest deduction. I have subsidized health care because it's provided through my employer, and that's another tax break. My 401k plan is tax deferred, and so we really do. People like to complain about the government, but the vast majority of the spending goes for things that people like defense and Medicare, health care, government health care, and the vast majority of those tax expenditures. People don't realize, and those are also things that people like healthcare and our savings, and so there hasn't been a real kind of discussion in this country about kind of where the money comes from and where the money goes, and I think this is really useful. What you're
sure.
doing, Marty.
Well, what you're doing as well, Michael. Thanks so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
It's been a pleasure.
And that's Michael Grunwald. He's senior national correspondent for Time magazine and, again, author of a book that came out earlier this year called The New Deal, The Hidden Story of Change in the Obama Era. And he also had an interesting piece in the current edition of Time magazine titled How to Avoid the Fiscal Cliff. And, yes, we'll be talking about a carbon tax after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
AT12 Productions, Philadelphia's all-comedy theater company, supports WHYY. Now on stage, Dave and Aaron Go to Work. Created and performed by Barrymore Award-winning Philadelphia artists Dave Jotico and Aaron Cromie. Dave and Aaron Go to Work harkens back to the days of Laurel and Hardy, Charlie Chaplin, and Buster Keaton in a wordless comedy for all ages. Tickets for Dave and Aaron Go to Work are available now at 215-592-9560 or at 1812productions.org.
Next time on America Abroad, youth were the force behind the Middle East revolutions that overthrew regimes and rallied for change. But as recent attacks at U.S. embassies and a crisis in Syria have revealed, the region is still in turmoil. Youth in the Arab world after the revolution. On the next America Abroad from WBUR and Public Radio International.
Tonight at 11 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Partners in Health celebrates 25 years of providing medical and moral care for some of the neediest around the world. We'll speak with one of the group's founders, Paul Farmer. Also, what makes for an ugly building? We'll take a look at a few of the best of the worst. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. UN climate talks are finishing up in Doha with little progress on how to reduce CO2 emissions, at least so far. Nonetheless, with the need to address the budget deficit and some mounting concerns about global climate change, some are talking about perhaps it's time for a tax on carbon. We asked David Weisbach to join us. He's the Walter J. Blum Professor of Law at the University of Chicago Law School, Senior Fellow at the Computational Institute of the University of Chicago and Argonne National Laboratory. And David Weisbach, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Very good to be here.
So do you think there is some growing support consensus for a carbon tax?
Hard to say. I think it'd be hard to get the Republicans to agree to a carbon tax, but I think we can always be hopeful.
and let me give out the phone number to our listeners, which is 1-888-477-9499. We'd be curious about where you stand on a carbon tax. Again, 1-888-477-WHYY. So, David Weisbach, where do you stand on a carbon tax?
Oh, it'd be a fantastic idea, if only we could convince Congress.
How would it work?
Well, you can do it a number of different ways, but the way that I and a number of other people that have studied it have imagined it would be that it would be imposed upstream so that you as a consumer wouldn't directly pay the tax, fill out forms, or anything like that. Instead, we would impose it on oil refineries or coal power plants or natural gas processors so that it would be embedded in the price of fossil fuels you'll pay. If you count the number of taxpayers we would need to impose a carbon tax on 100% of our emissions from fossil fuels, it's about 2,000, maybe 2,500 taxpayers that would actually have to fill out forms, be audited, and actually, you know, pay taxes to the government.
And how much do you think that carbon, I mean, you know, living in this fantasy world, how much do you think that carbon tax would be? Is there any way to know that?
The rate on the tax?
The rate on the tax, yeah.
Well, it could be almost anything, but numbers people talk about are anywhere from about $10 a ton of carbon to $50 or even $100 a ton of carbon. If you want to translate that into how much more would your gas cost at the pump, $20 tax on a ton of carbon would be about 20, maybe 25 cents on a gallon of gas.
And is one of the arguments for a carbon tax is that it covers the real cost of using fossil fuels?
Right. So there's actually an argument that people that believe in free markets should be the ones most strongly in favor of a carbon tax. And the reason why is if you believe in free markets, you should want goods to represent the price of goods to represent their true costs. And that way people, when they decide what to buy or what to do, can decide how to allocate their money based on the true costs. You want to buy things that give you the most benefit for the cost. But for that to be true, the price of the good has to reflect its cost. And right now, we're able to dump our garbage, if you will, the carbon dioxide we pollute, for free. And so we don't pay the cost of that garbage dumping. And so unlike other goods, where you pay the full cost when you emit carbon dioxide, you're not, and therefore free markets are not really operating properly. So someone who believes in the market should be strongly in favor of a carbon tax.
So the way it stands now, we are essentially subsidizing pollution?
That's the way to think about it, right. And if you believe in free markets, you don't want to have that subsidy.
Why do you think, and I know we have this cap and trade system, which is frankly complicated even to talk about, but why do you think something like a carbon tax, which sounds like it might be easier to institute, why do you think there isn't more support for it, for instance?
People hate the word tax.
Oh, is it? I mean, if we called it a carbon something or other, it might have more resonance?
Well, people may not be that easily fooled to call it a carbon price, but if people are averse to the word tax, and so if you make a very much more complicated system, you know, sort of jury-rigged with this and that, like what we saw with the Wagner-Markey cap-and-trade bill, people somehow like that better, even though it's more complicated and may not work as well.
And would, if there were, and I realize, you know, we're living in this little bit of fantasy world as we talk about this, but if there were a carbon tax, would that, in a sense, level the playing field for other forms of energy, like renewables, for instance?
Right. That's one of the arguments for a carbon tax, is ultimately we need to replace our energy system with renewable energy, like solar power or wind power. And right now, because fossil fuels get this implicit subsidy, solar power and wind power are at a disadvantage. And so if we had a carbon price, then solar power and wind power could compete on a more equal basis.
Let me see what some of our callers have to say. That phone number again, 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Talking with David Weisbach about some of the pros of a carbon tax. We'd be interested in pros and cons hearing from you. Let's see what Matt from Mount Airy has to say. And Matt, go ahead. You're on the air.
How you doing, people?
Good.
Morning.
Go ahead. You're on the air, Matt.
All right. Thank you. So basically, I, from my armchair perception of the economy, I find it almost impossible to grow GDP, per se, without an accompanying direct correlation of sort of pollution and greenhouse growth.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a way to have a healthy society with a shrinking economy? Or is there a way to grow the economy without polluting? How do we reconcile the massive direct correlation between growth and pollution?
Well, yeah, let me take that second part. Is that something you've thought about, David Weisbach?
Yes. Yeah, so there's a very high correlation between wealth and energy use. Indeed, right. There's almost no country in the world that manages to be wealthy, therefore having, you know, had the GDP grow and not using a lot of energy. So the key to the puzzle is to find a way to produce energy that doesn't cause pollution. Right, that's where wind power and solar power come in. But right now, we don't have that technology in place or haven't installed what we do. But Matt's exactly right that we need, if we want to continue growing and we want to continue using energy mm-hmm. to grow, because we seem to need to do that, we need to find a way to do that that doesn't cause pollution. And that's the, if you will, the really the central dilemma of climate change.
But do you honestly believe that you could power a wealthy country like the U.S. on, I won't say entirely on solar or wind or water power, but do you think that that's feasible?
Not right now. Right now we have about $5 trillion of installed base devoted to fossil fuel. And so shifting that $5 trillion of installed base to clean energy will take a lot of time. Mm-hmm. You can't simply do it overnight, but the technologies are close to there or there already, and we spend the next 30 or 40 years gradually winding down that fossil fuel base and installing a clean energy base. It's mm-hmm. entirely feasible.
And it seems that we're also dependent on fossil fuels that are, at least as we understand it, a finite source of energy.
We have enough fossil fuels to last for several hundred years at a minimum. It depends on which fuel you're talking about,
right.
But we have a lot of coal, and right now we have a lot of natural gas as well. So I think the finite source of fossil fuels is actually not an immediate concern, simply because we have so much of it right now.
My understanding is that U.S. emissions, at least in the last couple of years, have declined. Does that square with your thinking?
It has. It's been interesting. Our decline has been as much or greater than the decline in Europe, even though Europe has all these strong climate change policies.
And why is that, do you think?
It's because of natural gas. But part of it was the recessions. We had a decline during the recession just because the economy shrank. And then since then, it's really been because of the remarkable rise of natural gas. Natural gas is much cleaner fuel than coal is in terms of climate change.
But it still does emit CO2.
Yes, it's not a clean fuel. But if we substitute natural gas for coal, for the same energy, we produce far fewer emissions. And that's what's led to our decline over the last 4 or 5 years.
Have you made this argument to anyone that can change policy?
Well, you know, you go to Washington and you talk to people, and
yes.
They nod their head and, you know, nothing happens. And there's no enormous resistance to any new kind of tax. But if you think about it, we have a real fiscal hole, and a carbon tax can both raise a lot of money and improve our environment at the same time. It seems like it's an easy argument.
And there aren't too many if we'll call it a tax, there aren't too many taxes that also could help the environment, that at least that I'm aware of.
We don't have many in place. We do have a tax on gasoline right now, and that goes to supporting highways, but it also reduces pollution from driving. And we have a cap-and-trade system on sulfur dioxide, which operates similarly to a tax in a lot of ways. So we do have some similar systems, but nothing anywhere near the scale of a carbon tax.
Do you also think, I mean, I think of these powerful constituencies, you mentioned coal, oil, even natural gas. They are powerful players in Washington.
Yeah, and actually the problem when you think about their interest is it's not Republican versus Democrat, because coal is located in some Democratic states like West Virginia.
Right.
And so their interests are able to straddle the parties, if you will. And so you see many Democrats that would be opposed to action on climate change, because to a large extent it means reducing our reliance on coal. And so it creates a real political problem. But there are cracks in the fossil fuel facade. There are a number of utility companies, for example, that support a carbon tax, like Exelon.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's possible that the fossil fuel industry will eventually come around, that they might want certainty rather than the uncertainty about what's going to happen for climate change. Utilities might want to be able to know what they're going to charge their customers, which is one reason why Exelon has supported a carbon tax. So it's not impossible to overcome those interests, and it's not impossible that those companies will reduce their opposition to a carbon tax.
Let me see what David from Willow Grove has to say. David, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, this is a great academic discussion, but
Thank you.
Wanted to know what your guest thought about how regressive a carbon tax would be, as the lower income tend to spend most of their money on consumptive goods, and this would raise the price of just about everything.
Go ahead, David Weisbach.
Yeah, carbon tax would be, staking alone, would be regressive, and it's not just that lower income people spend more money on consumption goods, but they spend a relatively larger share of what they spend on consumption on energy.
Right.
Right, and that's what
to heat their house or apartment or for
right,
their
right.
Car.
They may have a smaller house, but given you know what they're spending, a larger portion of it is actually on energy, mm-hmm. and so a carbon tax is regressive. And so, if you're going to enact a carbon tax, you'd want to think about policies that offset that regressivity. And there's any number of them you can do. The choices are almost infinite. But you could, you know, lower the payroll tax or make the upper tax rates higher. There's any number of ways you could offset the progressivity, but David's certainly right that you'd want to think about that in conjunction with enacting a carbon tax.
I noticed that the payroll tax is in a lot of people's sights these days when looking at our overall tax system. That I don't know if there's any movement on rethinking that at all, but it's come up a number of times.
Well, it's an obvious candidate for, when you're thinking about progressivity, for mm-hmm. changing the system so that the system is more progressive, because it falls very heavily on lower income people, because it's a flat rate tax up to right around $100,000, and then it goes to zero. And so when you look at that tax rate structure, it's a pretty obvious candidate for something that can be changed to make the system overall more progressive.
Let me see what Steve from Manion has to say. And Steve, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, well, I've really been enjoying the conversation.
Thank you.
I agree wholeheartedly that I especially like the word carbon price, because I think that is actually more neutral.
Mm-hmm.
But what we're in the overall framework, I think it's going to be it's taking the low fruit even to go for carbon price. When you look at the cradle-to-grave costs, when you look at the health costs, the environmental costs, I mean, look at the ash dam that just busted out like a year or two ago with hundreds of millions of dollars worth of damage. And, you know, when you start folding that in, what if you get the true cost of production, I think it would really open people's eyes to the cost of alternate energy.
Yeah, go ahead, David Weisbach.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's really the argument for having a carbon price, which is we don't really see the true cost of fossil fuel. And you listed storms and damage, but what about also the military that we need to use to support oil shipments? Right, the true costs of fossil fuel are potentially enormous, and we don't really see those prices at all. It's all hidden through other mechanisms, and so having a carbon price that reflects the true costs might significantly change how people behave.
For instance, people are paying around, what, $4 a gallon at the pump now. The true cost, when you add in the military and everything like that, do you think it's closer to $10 a gallon?
You know, I don't know. It's very hard to do things like the military, because who knows why we have aircraft carriers in the Persian Gulf. And so it's hard to allocate that. But we can do simple calculations. If you had a carbon tax at $20 a ton, then it'd be $4.25 for gasoline. Coal prices, so electricity produced with coal would go up as a higher percentage, right? Because coal is the dirtiest of the fuels.
Right.
So anything that's produced with coal, the price would go up even more than, say, with gasoline. And gasoline is dirtier than natural gas, so the price of natural gas would go up the least. But it's hard to know what the full cost is, but we can calculate how much the price would go up for a given carbon price.
And does price then end up changing behavior? I mean, does it work that way?
Well, that's the goal. And for a long time, economists thought how much we drove didn't change very much, because if you live somewhere and you have to drive to work or the grocery store or take your kids to soccer, then you have to do that. It doesn't matter what the price is. But when the price of oil went up to, what, about $150 a barrel a few years ago, people really changed their driving habits, and very quickly. And everyone was somewhat surprised by it. But it turns out that, yes, the price of gasoline really changes behavior.
Well, on that note, you've given us some things to think about. David Weisbach, thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. He's the Walter J. Blum Professor of Law at the University of Chicago Law School, and he has been studying issues related to federal taxation and climate change. We also spoke with Michael Grunewald of Time Magazine. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about this program. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of the show. But do stay with us. We'll be right back. And coming up next, we'll be talking about El Sistema, an acclaimed